Welcome to We Are Libertarians. I am this week's host, Chris Spangle, and with me is Creighton Harrington and Chris Galt. How are you guys doing this week?
Great. How are you, Spangle?
I'm doing pretty good.
Pretty good.
You got to talk into the microphone.
Pretty good.
What are you doing?
Creighton, I'm trying to...
The podcast has started.
I'm trying to be funny.
Okay, well, you're making me laugh.
Pretty good.
Right. It's taken like a half an hour to start the show, more than normal. Like, we've just sat here, like, cracking jokes for more than a half an hour. This week's topics, we're going to talk a little bit about the Republican primary. We're going to maybe touch on Trayvon Martin a little bit. We're also going to talk about some political surveys that Creighton has. But first, let's talk about Obamacare. So let's tackle this a little bit. Oral arguments in the Supreme Court started this week, and I think they finished, actually. Mm-hmm. And next Wednesday, they will be talking about those oral arguments and making a decision soon. What were your impressions in watching the media of the oral arguments and the justices' reactions to the debate that's going on in the Supreme Court, Galt?
Well, I think it's pretty obvious that it was really polarizing. The justices seem pretty split, 4-4. I think the choice is going to come down to one justice. So either way, win or lose, it's going to be a 5-4 decision, I think.
Most of what I've encountered has been through talk radio. I actually haven't been able to get to a TV very much lately. But I don't know. I kind of share the same sentiment. I think it's going to be pretty close, 5-4. I don't see it doing anything else. And I was just saying before the show started that it's kind of – With the implications of this bill, should it go through, the precedent it will set as far as what government can do in the future, it's going to be very world changing to an extent for future generations. And in reality, it all comes down to one guy, one man. For like the rest of American history, is going to be the deciding factor for something so large and important.
Somebody get Anthony Kennedy a salad. Let's get him on a diet. Man, let's make sure he's okay. Let's. I think about that all the time. When I watched, the only reaction that I had to the State of the Union address is when Kennedy walked in, I was like, okay, good. He looks all right. Good. Okay, he looks good. Lucky he's working out. All right. You know, it is. And it seemed to me that I don't really follow the Supreme Court that closely. So I don't really know if this is different or not, but one thing that I picked up on the media coverage was the fact that the justices were trying to convince each other and making arguments for or against almost in public. And oftentimes when you watch the Supreme Court, whether it be the state Supreme Court here in Indiana or the national Supreme Court, that usually takes place behind the scenes and they're just asking leading questions or they're picking apart arguments of lawyers. But this seemed to be, you know, people like Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Justice Scalia were picking apart each other's arguments, which seemed to be a little bit different, which tells me that this is a huge deal with the Supreme Court.
No, absolutely. I mean, I don't think anyone in their right mind doubted that this was going to be super, super political. Looking back in retrospect, the fact that it is all going to come down to Kennedy was like, I mean, who didn't see that coming? I mean, who really didn't see, you know, it going to be split 4-4 and one guy who never makes his mind up about anything until the last minute is going to be the deciding factor? I mean, Scalia, Roberts, Ginsburg, they all knew what they were going to, how they were going to do it, what they were going to vote before they walked in that chamber. So yes, I mean,
I've seen a lot of the justices be really vocal about it, and that's not something I see out of the justices that often.
Almost never. They try to be very impartial, but on this, it's clear that they're not impartial, that they have decided opinions that they are announcing before they even really sit down and discuss this case.
Right.
I have a question that I posed to you two. Do you think that is because of short-term political gain, like they want to have this bill passed because it's the Democrats' baby, it's a liberal, they want it liberal, liberalism, modern American liberalism has wanted universal health care to an extent for a long time. Do you think it's because of that, or do you think that these that want this mandate passed want it because they understand the humongous precedent they're going to set?
Like we said last week when we sort of touched on this, the courts are politicized, but they do try to take a longer-term view than politicians do, than people who are seeking re-election. And that's one of the reasons that we're set up with the Supreme Court that doesn't have to run for re-election. So they can take a longer view. They can make decisions that are not going to affect them in midterm elections or for re-election. And that's one of the benefits of having the Supreme Court decide some of these cases. And I think they take a longer view of it than just the immediate political climate. I don't think they make a decision based on how will this help the Republican nominee or the Democratic nominee in the December election. I think they look at it – you look at Kagan, for instance. Kagan should have recused herself, but she didn't. And that's because she is on record in government emails, which are public documents, supporting this entire act. And so there's no doubt which way she's going to fall. Sotomayor is probably right along there with her because those are two recent nominees. People who have been on the court for a long time, they sort of become more and more moderate. Rehnquist, for instance, wrote documents. I think it was Greenspan who dated, I think, Ayn Rand. But Rehnquist was a very hardcore conservative who became more moderate over time as he was on the court. I would recommend everybody read Jeff Toobin's book, The Nine. I listened to the audiobook about it, and it really gives you a great inside look on how the Supreme Court operates and how they approach these kind of cases. It gives you a little bit of history about the Supreme Court, and it also talks about how it functions and operates in the modern era. And it was really eye-opening to get a view of something that you don't often see. And Jeff Toobin, who works for NBC News, is a great person to listen to when issues of the Supreme Court come up. So I think they take a little bit of a longer view than this immediate election cycle. I think they have a grasp of how big this could be for the American population. And they talked about it. I mean, are you going to force people to buy broccoli? I mean, do they have to buy broccoli? What is to stop President Obama and Congress passing a law that Michelle Obama is in favor of that says every person should have to eat a pound of broccoli a year? You have to purchase a pound of broccoli to be a legal American citizen. Like, insurance is a product. It is a private product that the government is forcing us to buy. And the government is really overstepping its bounds, and I think that that's where they're going to strike it down, because this is the first time the federal government has required you to buy a product as an individual.
Well, what's stopping them from making a law about you buying broccoli is public outrage. It would not flow well with the American people. But most people want to help people, and that's why they're fine with health insurance.
But what Kappas talked about in the Great Lost podcast that never aired, we did a podcast about the ACLU. And they talked about we talked about the ACLU and how there are some things where the ACLU will defend a neo-Nazi, because it's very hard to defend neo-Nazis or the Westboro Baptist Church. And they do that to get their foot in the door. Local governments and state and federal governments go after people who are unpopular because it's easier to make that case. So this is a case where they're trying to put their foot in the door with making you buy a product, because most people really, at the end of the day, want the government to pay for their health care. They're not going to like the outcomes, but they don't want to have to pay for health care anymore, because everybody likes quote-unquote free stuff. And so that's what this is really about. The public outrage over broccoli, yeah, because no one likes broccoli. But everybody likes health care that's mostly paid for by the government.
And
well, there's no such thing as a free lunch.
No, there isn't.
Hand stoffel.
But he has a point, and it's just merely that while it is – I mean, I really can't think of really anything else that's by and large going to be more popular than health care to, you know, have the government provide for everybody. And – no, this is not. That is not technically what this bill does. It doesn't technically mean that you have to, that the government's going to provide your health care. But I can't really see anything else where they could, you know, get that through. They could get through a provision that says you have to buy something. So yeah, it's incrementalism. I mean, after, you know, so many years go by, people are going to be used to the idea that you have to pay this. You have just like, you know, the income tax. I mean, for a while you didn't have an income tax, and everybody's like, "Oh, there's going to be, you know, no one. There's going to be riots and
outrage."
But after a while, people just got used to it. Now it's just like you're almost not American if you don't really pay your taxes, and that same thing will happen. It's like you'll have to buy health insurance, and then after a while, people will just be like, "Well, we're buying health insurance, and it's just been the way it's been, and it's going to keep adding on." Do you have to buy Goodyear tires? Do you have to buy Chevys? Do you have to buy Israeli flowers? Do you have? I mean, it's just going to continue on and on until you actually. I mean, we're in. I mean, it's incremental socialism is all, or fascism is actually a better word. It's incrementalism. It's and it's incrementalism in the exact opposite direction we need to go.
Sure.
Well, in my con law course yesterday, I actually got to sit as a Supreme Court justice and rule on on the constitutionality of healthcare.
They didn't give you a gavel, did they?
No.
He did wear the wig, though.
But both sides...
white rolled wig?
No. But both sides got to present their case, and there were three justices, not nine, but there were three of us. The result ended up being... I voted that it was unconstitutional. The girl next to me voted that it was, and the other one went in part.
Yeah.
So it was basically a tie. But the after the ruling and everything, I was drilled with questions by our class because my class is mostly full of liberals.
Did you say, well, and, see, I'm probably the only one in the room that's actually read the Constitution.
Well, I have to argue all the time about it, but... someone in my class argued for liberty and said that libertarians and people like us should want national health care because the government's job is to protect life, liberty, and property, right?
Right.
Well, how can someone enjoy liberty without the right to have a good health? And that they have to have good health
to enjoy
that liberty.
Are you posing this question to us seriously, or are you just saying
no,
so
this is what I was told, and
you.
He quoted Amartya Sen, and he said... I can't remember the quote he used, but he said that Amartya Sen, read some Amartya Sen, and that'll show you, you know,
I mean,
that libertarians should be for this health care and not against it.
And I'll argue against him, because if you look at, I actually listened a couple years ago to a Cato event where they were talking about health care, and it was a woman who was from Canada who talked about the Canadian health care system and their system of care. It's totally free up there. But the problem is there are less MRIs in Canada than there is in Seattle. There are 33 MRI machines in all of Canada. And this was in 2009, I think it was, that 2009 or 2010 that this took place. There was a guy, and I don't know the outcome of the case, but he was suing the Canadian government for paying for his medical bills because he had a splitting headache, and the symptoms of the headache were very similar to a brain tumor. And he went to the doctor, to his Canadian doctor. It took 4 weeks to finally get in to see a specialist. And the specialist said, "I'm almost sure that you have a brain tumor. So we're going to go ahead and schedule an appointment with an MRI and or a PET scan or a CAT scan or whatever it was. And we're going to check out that what I think is a tumor. So your next date, the next available date is 4 weeks from now. And then after they do the scan, you'll have to wait another 4 to 5 weeks to actually see a physician or a surgeon to get the tumor removed. So that's a total of 12, well over 12 weeks, which is roughly 3 to 4 months. So what he does is, like, he goes and he finds someone to take the tumor out for him. He drives to Buffalo. They do a CAT or a PET scan that day. He goes to surgery the day after that. And they said that if he had stayed in Canada and used the Canadian system of government, he would have died. He would not be alive. And so he took his medical bills and he sent it to the Canadian government and said, "You guys pay for it." And they said, "No, we're not going to do that because you didn't have the surgery in Canada." And he said, "Well, then should I sue you for attempted murder? You know, where do you draw the line? You hear people in the United Kingdom who are dying of dehydration and are drinking the water out of plants because that's the only way to get water. They water the plants, but they don't water the people. because the access to care, because when something is free, quote unquote free, everybody floods to that care and it overwhelms the system.
No, yeah, that's true. And
in Canada, you don't even have a pediatrician or your own doctor. You have a family doctor. So if I get sick, I know I can call Dr. Kerstef, okay, and I can go see him within a week. You don't have family doctors in Canada. You have to go to the hospital, and that's it.
Well, I mean, I think we've all, you know, especially in 2009 and 10, we all heard about, you know, the horror stories of, you know, socialized medicine. I mean, I remember reading about how Russian medicine was. You'd have, I mean, before the Soviet Union collapsed, there were doctors, you know, alcoholic doctors coming to work doing surgeries, you know, drunk as heck. I mean,
Porter vodka.
I mean, but to the guy's point, the guy's making an argument saying that libertarians believe in life, liberty, and property, and the protection of your life, liberty, and property. And he's saying that you can't, that essentially he's equating health with life. There's a number of philosophical, you know, questions being raised in that statement. For one, I think he sounds like a utilitarian. He sounds like more people, he believes more people will be helped by universal health care. But at the same time, either he doesn't recognize or he's doesn't care because he's a utilitarian that you say that it comes from somebody and that somebody gets it taken from them by force. Should we remove the free will of another individual that's a doctor or a healthcare provider in order for him to provide healthcare for 10, 15 people? What is the most benefit? So I'd say that he sounds like a utilitarian. But at the same time, the argument of life, liberty, and property, it comes with the caveat, as long as your life, liberty, and property do not infringe on the equal rights of another. And that, I mean, that immediately shatters his entire argument. You can't profess to believe in freedom, you know, an individual's right to individual liberty and his own property. You can't profess to believe in that while at the same time saying that in order for that situation to exist, I have to take or infringe on someone else's life, liberty, or property.
Well, and it's also saying that the government should tell people how to practice medicine. It's telling people that your skills as a doctor belong to the community. You know, it's communal thinking. It's not libertarianism where I study and I become a doctor and I practice to be a doctor and then I get to take those skills and charge money for it. So there is a bit of communistic thinking in that our skills belong to the community, that a doctor has to work for the good of society because society gave him those skills, and that's not the way that it works. I have skills in political science, and I charge money for that skill. I practice it, and I get better at it. I have experience in political science, and that's why I charge money for it. And I'm not ashamed to say that because I'm not ashamed to make a living at something that I practice. And doctors shouldn't be either.
Yeah, and that's true. And the immediate response that you'll get to that is that, well, doctors or medicine is different because, you know, if they decide that they don't want to do it, then, you know, people die. And it's not fair because they're going to die and rah, rah, rah. And it's like, I mean, people, we don't live in a perfect world. You shouldn't drive a car because you could die. And if somebody charges you to do something that has exist on this planet, you could die in the engagement of whatever that is that you were paying for. I mean, yes, doctors are in a profession to make people, to help people. They're in a profession to make people be not sick or not have to fix broken bones. That's their profession. But if you concede for a minute that, or if you begin to concede that a doctor or a healthcare provider should not be allowed to make a decision, and that a separate third party, whether that be government, whether it be anybody, a separate third party has the ultimate say over how you and your doctor engage in medicine.
Voluntary agreements.
The minute you do that, you are conceding that you and your doctor don't know what's best, or your doctor may not. Or you, I mean, it's your responsibility if you think your doctor's terrible and you think that the government should have standards for doctors. That's your responsibility to go to one doctor, then another doctor, get a second opinion. That's your responsibility, and you have no one but yourself to blame if one doctor's stupid and you didn't and you thought so and you didn't go to somebody else. That's your fault. And if a doctor has a diagnosis that is, you know, perfect, but it doesn't jive with, you know, the Medicare regulate bureaucrats, and then somebody dies, that's not the doctor's fault, that's not the person's fault, that is the government's fault. And it may be a person's fault to an extent because they didn't have to choose to be on the government system.
One of the foundations of libertarianism is voluntary. I always have trouble saying this. Voluntarianism. Help me. Yes.
Voluntarism.
The fact that I voluntarily go to a doctor and the doctor voluntarily says, yes, I will see you. And once you add a bureaucrat into the middle of that, then it becomes involuntary. You no longer have a choice. The government is forcing you to take a course of action with your care because they're paying for it. You know, it's not free health care. It's just that you don't cut the check right away. You cut the check with your taxes. And that's why the mandate is so essential to Obamacare. If you don't mandate that every citizen buy care or pay a fine, then the whole thing breaks down. They cannot fund it. It becomes an unfunded mandate, much like No Child Left Behind. There are many things that the government they mandate, but they can't fund, which means people can't follow the law. And we become, you know, a bit of a banana republic because people just – laws are made and no one can follow them.
Well, right now the government forces us to buy car insurance if we want to drive.
But that's state by state by state.
But that's still government forcing us to buy
car. Yeah, but you could lobby your legislature and get it changed.
I'm not okay with forcing people to buy car insurance, but – you don't have to drive to exist. It's different with their health care argument. They're saying,
right,
in order to be a human in this country, you have to have health care.
Right.
You don't have to drive. Now, I would say that I would not like to have to buy car insurance if I didn't want to, because I'm a free individual. But
insurance is a risk. It's a gamble, too.
But there is a little bit more – it's a little bit bigger with what they're trying to pass with health care.
Right. The car insurance is for – harming someone else in case you know, to pay for someone else's bills, and health insurance is paying for your own bills, your own costs.
The reason healthcare is so expensive is the entire healthcare industry is the one industry we've not outsourced.
And no, everything I disagree. The main reason that it's so expensive is because it's one of the most socialized sectors of our economy.
Right.
I mean, regardless of, they're talking about socialized medicine, healthcare is by and large the most regulated and most socialized sector that we have. Medicare and Medicaid alone have price controls and product, you know, supply controls that completely distort the market for the, like, however many percent left that is private insurance. I mean, and laws and regulations have turned insurance and less into insurance and more into subsidy. It's not so much that you're paying. I mean, if an insurance is paying for you to go see what your cough is, then, and it's just a physical, then it's not insurance. The insurance is for risk, something that you couldn't foresee, not a weekly check or yearly checkup.
And that's part of the problem is, I know my wife, every time she gets a cold, she has to go to the doctor's visit. And I look at her and I say, how much did that doctor's visit cost? She goes, well, $20. I go, no. They charged your insurance $100 and you $20. Every time you go to the doctor, every time you take your kids to the doctor, every time you have a sniffle, you're charging your insurance $120. And if we did a couple things, if we detached insurance from employers and got away from group insurance and every individual had to shop for their own insurance, it would become cheaper because people would make informed decisions. And my wife then wouldn't just say, well, it only cost me $20. She would say, oh, wow, this costs $120, so I better shop around and make sure that I go to the right doctor. If I'm going to go, I go for the right reasons. If I just need a prescription, I go to an ImmediaCare that will charge me less for a visit, and we become smart consumers. We're not smart consumers of healthcare whatsoever. People just go to the doctor and pay later. and they look for insurance that will give them the lowest copays.
But that is how the system is set up. I mean,
exactly.
The entire system is set up around the idea that you go and pay a copay at most, and sometimes you don't pay anything at all. Let the other third party take care of the cost. Doctors recognize, hospitals recognize this. They're in there to make money too. I mean, they recognize that they don't have to really necessarily worry about price to an extent. They can keep charging as much as they want because the insurance company is going to pay for it. All the person cares about is their premium or their copay. So the system is set up to promote higher prices and less supply, higher prices, and less innovation. It's set up that way. I mean, you can't have price controls on any market in the entire American economy and expect there to be efficiency and quality. I mean, that is what we do with Medicare and Medicaid. So, I mean, to a large extent, we can complain about the lack of quality and the high prices, and that's. But it's our own freaking fault for expecting the government or a third-party private insurance to pay for everything.
If it sounds like Creighton is losing his train of thought, it's because Galt won't stop making hand motions over
I'm
here.
Sorry.
Would you come down over there?
Well,
we need to be put in charge of everything. Why are the three of us not in charge of everything?
Well,
We've got it all figured out.
I have a real-world world example for this healthcare that's happened to me.
Your lobotomy went well?
No, I have a really expensive eyeglass prescription. Mm-hmm. My glasses are quite expensive, and I was walking around the mall one day, and LensCrafters had a sign outside that said, buy one, get one free prescription glasses.
Mm-hmm.
So I walk in, and I go up there, and she's like, yeah. Do you have insurance? And I was like, well, yeah, I have eyeglasses insurance. And she said, well, then it's full price. It's not buy one, get one free, because your insurance will pay for what you would have saved yourself. And
right.
I just thought, well, how does that make sense at all?
Right.
They're charging more money. They're over full price because I have insurance, because they're going to pay for it and not me.
So you were going to
get, but I'm still paying for it because I'm paying for the insurance.
You were going to get two pairs, but you were just going
I
to pay the full price.
I only got one because it was about the same price after
gotcha.
Insurance discounts, but
again,
but
it's the, not
the
discounts,
point is,
it's You're taking money
businesses,
out of a pool of money from
right.
other
businesses
people.
Businesses can take advantage of that, and that's why prices are high. No one's going to get cheap health care because they're going to go in and they're going to say, you have insurance, right? You have to. And then they're going to say, well, then we're going to charge you as much as we can because the insurance is going to pay for it.
And I hope people understand that. That's why Obamacare and socialized medicine is bad, because what makes health care expensive right now, which is a giant pool of money that people take from that pool of money without really thinking about why they're taking out of that money, that just gets exponentially worse when people think that it's totally free. It's just going to get worse and worse and worse under socialized medicine, and people just don't seem to get that. And it's also part of the problem. There's a couple things here. The first thing is that we have this attitude. We talk about it almost every week because it's sort of at the base of all of our problems, is that you think that you should be able to walk out of your house and have absolutely nothing bad ever happen to you. And that's just not how life works. My mom has a famous saying, life sucks and then you die. Like, that's a little more cynical than maybe I look at it. But, I mean, that sort of is, bad things happen to people sometimes. And the second thing is, and this is a very common view for liberals, they think that we have to protect the bottom 1% of people by dragging down the top 99% of people and making things worse for the middle class and the upper class. The lower class of people, and I don't want to use the word lower because that – but working class people should have special subsidies paid for by the middle class and the upper class.
And am I the only one that thinks that is just ridiculously almost evil? I mean, maybe there are good intentions there, but it's either just incredibly stupid
it's not evil. It's just stupid.
But I mean why is it not? I mean, okay. Libertarians tend to believe in the free market, and one of the reasons that a lot of people that are libertarian, they're utilitarians. They believe in the market because they believe that it'll do the best for the most.
Mm-hmm.
And while I'm not a libertarian because I'm a utilitarian, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're wrong. Historically, if you look at as much data as you can find, those countries that were the freest ended up having produced the most, increased standard of living the most, and the bottom 1 or bottom 10% really grew faster than the top 10%. And the gap of equalization, now it's been growing. The gap between the rich and the poor has been growing in the past, you know, decade, I think. But by and large, from the writing of the Constitution to now, the gap is between the rich and poor has lessened, and the poor have gotten richer. The poor have gotten richer faster than the rich have gotten richer. And I mean, it's just if your goal is to help out the bottom 10% because they're unfortunately poor, then help them out. But do it through production, expand the wealth of the entire nation, and let the poor have some of that. Not take it from the top and put it to the bottom. I mean, it's not a zero. The market is not a zero sum game.
Right. I saw a joke on Facebook this week, and it said the communist walks by a rich man's house and says, "No man should have that much." And a capitalist walks by the same house and says, "Everyone should have that much." And I think that's the point that Creighton's trying to make, is that we shouldn't want to take from the rich people. We should want everyone.
We should
want to
make everybody better.
Yeah.
You know, and that's all. Yeah. So, go ahead.
I was just going to say, back to the Supreme Court a little bit. I know we kind of trailed off a little bit, but
listen, we're passionate.
I had
passionate
a serious
men.
Question about this.
Okay.
That maybe one of you guys can answer. I didn't get to ask my con law professor, not that she would know anyway. but don't to bring something up to the Supreme Court. It has to have affected someone. It has to be timely. You have to have standing.
Right.
So the healthcare bill hasn't affected anyone yet, because it hasn't went into effect.
The right to petition.
But you don't. You can't just go to the Supreme Court and say, "I think this is unconstitutional."
They did. And they already discussed why they can do that on the first day of argument.
Well, why?
Because that goes against everything I've read. I think it's because they're saying the Obama administration's saying it's a tax. They're saying it's a tax, and
right.
they went over this law that.
But to challenge the tax, you have to pay the tax first.
That's what they were saying would happen with this bill that passed in like 1887 or something. They said that if this is what happens, then we can't really challenge this until 2015. But the Supreme Court said we're going to go ahead and go with it, and they're going to challenge it. They already established that they can talk about it. That was the first day of argument.
I know exactly what you're saying. I don't know why this was able to go forward because people didn't.
I can think of many unconstitutional things that I'd like the Supreme Court to hear on, and they don't because it hasn't affected anyone yet. The NDAA will never be brought up to the Supreme Court until someone gets detained.
Right.
And someone sues the government for it.
It might have something to do with, you know, they're all attorney generals. They're all states that are suing.
That's part of it, I think.
So, right, so it's like the federal state, government making a law.
But it hasn't affected the states yet.
Yeah, but it has affected the states. In Indiana, they had a program, a Medicare program. Mitch was touting it. I think it's Helping Hoosiers, something like that. And that program was killed almost immediately after Obamacare passed. And so think about who created the federal government. It was state governments. The state governments chartered the federal government, and they're the ones who have the ultimate authority over the federal government.
And that obviously
has been eroded over time.
Yeah, we would like that. We look at it from that perspective, but I don't think those justices are looking at it from that perspective. They're not hearing the case because the states are bringing it up because they're sovereign and it's a compact theory.
You would be surprised. Like people like Clarence Thomas and Scalia – and Rehnquist, they looked at it from that perspective, and they still, I mean, Rehnquist obviously is passed on, but if you read The Nine by Tubin, and he, you know, at the time, Sotomayor and Kagan were not profiled, it was Breyer at the time, and some of the others, I mean, Clarence Thomas views everything through federalism. Like, if it doesn't jive with his theory of federalism, he votes it down. And that may be part of the reason that this was brought up, but I honestly can't tell you.
I just
sure. So, if anybody
seems like things you learn in con law don't really apply to the real world, huh?
Yeah, guess what? Bad news for you.
Wait. College doesn't reflect reality? What?
I remember going to college once, and then once. I forgot it all. So,
okay.
I graduated, then I started learning stuff.
I got bad. Yeah, exactly. You're going to be really surprised when you leave college that you're like, man, the only thing I use is writing.
No, I already recognize. My econ professors are just stupid.
Okay, well, you want me to edit that out, buddy? Or hopefully they're not listening.
Not all my professors
not all of them, but it's not their fault. It's the theory that they have to teach.
Well, I was going to move on to something else, but let me ask you guys, as libertarians who are in college now, how do you deal with that? Do you get in? I'm sure Galt gets in a lot of fights with professors, but like, how much do you fight with professors? Do you guys feel like there is certainly a bias? Do you feel persecuted? It helps some of us old people out, as Galt called me earlier. He's like, oh, you're so gross. You're old. I'm like, I'm 28, jerk. But, I mean, how is the modern college era, how does that kind of jive with being libertarians, Galt?
Well, in my philosophy class yesterday, I told you that it was a week we were supposed to talk about liberty. And I was all excited. We had to read John Stuart Mill's On Liberty, and I was going to go in there and talk about liberty and go in there. And he says, Chris, you're going to argue and write laws for the paternal side. And I just thought, of course I am. And I don't – not that he did that on purpose. He might have, because he did choose the groups.
He might have done it to try and stretch you.
Because he knew I was a libertarian. Right. We've talked about it before. I was wearing my Young Americans for Liberty shirt, and I had to argue for paternalism. And I had to write a law that banned smoking in every place in America.
Explain paternalism for those who don't know.
Right. Basically,
it's Maury.
It's the
you
what
know Maury.
You do what's best.
Is
for...
Is that the guy who does all the baby tests on Saturday? Yeah.
Well, it's his philosophy.
It basically paternalism is just doing what's best. Letting the government do what's best for society.
Paternalism, like father.
Yes, like. Government's not doesn't need to impose values that aren't good.
Sure.
Like, healthcare is for the betterment of everyone. Obama's not doing it because he's evil. He's doing it because he wants to help people. And he's just wrong about the way he wants to do that. That would be paternalism, I guess.
So does that mean that... So do you guys feel like you're persecuted ever, or do they just kind of challenge you and try to challenge your beliefs?
Me personally, I haven't really encountered really strong bias. I'm not super outspoken in class. I kind of just like to go with the flow. I already know a majority of what they're trying to tell me anyway.
Total crap.
I'm not just trying to sound conceited or anything. Like my economics class, I mean, I know going in that I'm not going to agree with those professors. And I know going in those professors just want to teach the curriculum and get it over with. And I'm not going to convince them in a 1 hour class why neoclassical theory is fundamentally wrong on an epistemological level.
Oh my god, what a nerd.
It's not going to happen.
You have a girlfriend?
So,
wow.
So
she plays Call of Duty.
I love my girlfriend. She looks just like Mary Rothbard.
One time, oh man, she said, I told her who I was reading a book written by Murray Rothbard, and she was like, she texted me and she's like, aren't you reading that by Murray Rothbard or
Murray Rothbardian.
just like some random
letters after the Roth.
But anyway, my point is that I'm pretty, you know, convicted on my I have a little bit conviction on my perspectives of, you know, philosophy and whatnot. And I mean it's one of my passions is to actually like understand it more and gain knowledge on it. And in economics is my that's my bag. I love economics. So I go into class knowing so much about, you know, not even the stuff they're talking about, but like, you know, the philosophy of method and how, you know, with the history of this philosophy and why there's, you know, the premises of these things are wrong. And I could sit there and argue with my teacher all class, and I could probably keep him going the whole class period. But I really don't. I know there are a couple of econ professors that are they're avowed socialists, and they're making people read class books over how capitalism has failed and all this kind of stuff. I haven't had those.
Well, don't you feel a duty to counteract that brainwashing, though?
I do.
I do to an extent. But I feel like I could do it better through different means. There's no way that I could sit there in class and explain how the positivist method of neoclassical economics is flawed and not as sufficient as the axiomatic method of Ludwig von Mises. All right, I could sit there and talk about that all class.
And guess what?
No one
they're gonna care less.
Exactly.
<They're>
like, my well, point is
but
that
you can frame your arguments where people will listen.
Like, let's say Snooki has three children, and Snooki goes to buy.
No, but I mean, so, my point is that if I'm going in there and I'm listening to a guy talk about the GDP, and I disagree with the use of GDP statistics because they underestimate the amount of production needed for an economy to grow and be, you know, sufficient. They try and take into account, but they just don't. Right. And I can explain that based upon the method of Austrian economics, and I could explain it, but I mean, most of those people,
the whole class
don't
is just going to hate you for being the nerd.
Yeah, they're like, all they care about.
I guess I don't ever have to argue economics.
All they care about is that final, that common final at the end of the thing, and they want to get that grade. It's a little bit different in philosophy because, I mean, that is always under discussion. They teach economics as, like, you know, a hard science. There isn't much left to be debated as far as method. It's data and test and all this jazz. They don't realize it's a social science to a large extent. I mean, they say they do, but they kind
of
don't.
Which means it's theories. I mean, it's sort of the Christian debate of creationism versus evolution. Both are theories. You know, one of them are not hard science. It's a theory of how society works. And economics is a theory of how things work.
And yeah, and so I notice when, like, I will say, I did give in at one point my first semester this year.
So this guy came in and he started talking about supply side economics was more superior, and I was just outraged. I had to speak up.
No. This is actually a little bit worse than that, than that mockery. We were talking about it was my microeconomics class, and by some amazing ridiculous way, we ended up going through the entire class and not once talked about marginal utility, which, for those who know what the heck I'm talking about.
How foolish of that professor.
I mean, it really is pretty foolish.
Guess what? We have a new idiot of the week.
It really is pretty foolish. But anyway, we were talking about, she kind of hinted at it, one of the things that was called willingness to pay, and she showed a stair step of a supply curve and all this, and there was only like five people buying, and it's just kind of like hinting at marginal utility and Robinson Crusoe economics, but not really going there. But part of it was a demand curve that was horizontal. And for those who know anything about Austrian economics, you know that you can't have a horizontal demand curve. It's literally impossible. I'm not going to go into it, but the implications are just impossible. So that being said, I disagreed with what she was saying, and at the end of class I said, that can't happen. You can't have a horizontal demand curve. And it wasn't really time to argue about it because there was another class coming in, and I said, I'll write it down, and I'll send it to you, my argument. And I have one already prepared. No, I didn't have one already.
Prepared white papers.
I didn't have one already prepared.
Exact thing. Would you like to check out my blog,
however,
Technical Analysis of the Economy at blogspot.com.
But however, I did go home and write it, and it was 13 pages.
What? And did she reply?
Single spaced.
Did she reply?
She replied with one paragraph that said, that's the Austrian theory of economics. We teach neoclassical here. That being said, I don't know if I buy it. And she didn't try and answer any of my points or anything. She just said, I don't know if I buy it.
Right, because it's like I'm a history nerd, so I can get kind of in-depth into history just like you're getting into. I don't really know economics at all. I'm not interested by it in any way, but I am history. And so I would argue all the time with history professors. So, like, there was one time where I just had this one professor. The first day, she said the first Supreme Court justice was John Marshall. And I just was like, seriously? You could not be more wrong. It was John Jay. And then I just didn't listen the rest of the year.
Well, my con law professor told us you have to be 30 to run for president. No, but I take it a different approach than
nerds.
I know.
We just laugh at that, man. We're such nerds.
I take my approach to school much differently than Creighton does. I feel like if all my professors are going to teach like liberal, the only way that other students are going to learn is if I speak up and against or argue with them. So I constantly, all class period, raise my hand and argue with the
professor. It is just so against your nature to be confrontational,
Chris. I actually have a checklist in con law of how many times I can get the professor to say debatably. Because that's her cop-out. I'll make a good point, and she'll say, well, that's debatable. And then she'll move on. Well, and I'm got a pretty decent tally going right now.
Well, yeah, but how's your grade? It's not just me, but your again, grade well, is the tally that matters.
I'll get a good grade. It's okay. Most teachers grade on participation and not your views. That's the one thing I like about it is they don't judge you for your views. Yet. I haven't had a professor that's done that to me yet. Last semester in my public affairs course, we actually took the political compass quiz, which places you, you know,
yeah,
right,
and,
left.
And again, as I was saying earlier, though, before you comment on my approach to schooling, I don't take many classes where we're actually supposed to debate.
Okay.
I took a political science class last semester, and it was less about the issues and more about how our electors, you know, apportioned by state.
Fair enough. We have
so
different majors.
My econ
all of my
classes,
classes are,
like I said, econ is there's debate and argument within the economics world, but it doesn't happen in an introduction to macroeconomics class. It all happens on like peer reviewed journals and stuff.
Although, just the way you talk, I thought you were a little farther than intro.
Yeah,
I didn't. I didn't. Well, that's just my point. I didn't. I didn't declare a major until my second year. And I only was able to take the second semester of my second year. So I've only had three classes. One of those didn't even come over from my previous school.
What do you want to eventually do? What do you want to do when you grow up?
Public policy stuff.
What about you, Galt? What do you want to be when you grow up?
I want to change
President.
The world.
President? Yeah. Well, I got bad news for you. You're not at Harvard right now.
No, but I was talking about, I had to take the political compass quiz last semester, and it's like 100 questions. You can take it online anyway. But I scored all the way to the bottom right. And anyway, our professor showed the circle of where 98% of people land, right in the middle, and there's a Democrat, Republican in the middle. And he described himself at the top left with Gandhi. And then he asked us all to place our dots up on the board on where we were, with because we had to print it out. And I went and put mine up, and he said, there's no way, that's wrong. And I said, no, here's my answers and my score. And he said, wow. So, and in front of the whole class, he says, so let me get this straight. Let me see if I can figure you out. You don't agree with either of the major political parties. And I was like, no, not really. Yes, you got that right. And he said,
right.
Then he said, I bet you like Ayn Rand. And
he's like,
I was
I've
like,
seen one of you before, a long time ago.
He's like, well, I've never seen anyone score that low, or that low on the graph
right.
towards libertarian. But I thought it was funny. And then, so the rest, that was like the second class. So the rest of the year, I had that, everyone knew I was the Ayn Rand libertarian. And I had that opportunity to talk about my points of views. When people gave their presentations over policies, I would just rail them with questions.
Yeah, most professors see people who don't really think about a subject. I mean, college, in my experience from the 2 years that I went, it wasn't about rote memorization. It was about thinking. It was about teaching you how to think outside the box.
Yes.
And so many people that's one of the reasons that I hated college, especially at IUPUI. Nothing against IUPUI, because you both go there. It's a great school. But there are a lot of people who are full-time parents or full-time employees who have lives outside of it, and they want to get the piece of paper so they can move up in the world, and they're not that interested in learning.
Well, that's exactly why my econ teachers infuriate me, is because it's not about thinking outside the box. It's about
right.
learning the theory that is the mainstream theory. You don't. I mean, you go to that class. You don't even think. I mean, I'm a nerd about it. But it, I mean, if I was just a layman and I went in there, I would not even know that there were debates.
Right.
Amongst
because most students just kind of want to go along to get along to get the piece of paper, and that's just sort of how most people are in general. And we were going to talk a little bit about Trayvon, but it's sort of a minefield, and we don't know enough about it to really. And
yeah.
Frankly, I don't think the media or anybody who's talking about Trayvon Martin really has any idea about anything, so we're just going to avoid that topic this week. But this kind of dovetails into something that Creighton brought in today from one of his classes. He apparently is grading a survey or tallying a survey from one of his classes, a political class, and has some interesting answers in there that will kind of show you where the student body is when with regards to politics. So explain this a little bit more.
Okay, so I'm in a speech class, and I have to give a speech over persuasive speech over a policy. I'm picking civil liberties, mostly Patriot Act, NDAA, stuff like that, how it's wrong, blah, 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 that thing. But we had to give surveys over to see where the class stands on their knowledge of the topic, their opinion of the topic. Like, if they all agreed with me, then I can't really give that speech because I got to persuade them. But so these are completely anonymous. So anyone in my class that hears these, your names aren't on these, so I'm not going to get in trouble. But I just read some of the gems off here.
The gems.
Which of these best describes your political philosophy? Republican. And I mean, I feel like that's Jim because it's a party, but,
mm-hmm.
I have a number of these where it said, how old were you on September 11, 2001? And I had a number of people go 10, 11.
Because math is too hard to subtract. But, let's see here. 1984 minus 2000. Oh, no. I don't know
what month I was born right. in, so or, it could be either one.
Or in your mind, what is the single greatest threat to the national security of the United States? Terrorist.
Well, of course.
It's just grammar is amazing.
It just said, though, it's just the word terrorist. It's not terrorism. It's not a system of thought. It's just one terrorist.
Single terrorist.
I have a libertarian in the class, apparently.
Oh, wow.
Let's see if I need more. What is the single greatest threat to national security of the United States? Ourselves.
That is the libertarian. Yeah. It's like,
we will end our own existence. It's like, oh, libertarians are such downers.
So what are you going to do with the results of these?
I got to tally them all up, put them together, and then I have to make a speech based upon
the results.
The results, essentially. it's just supposed to be way too
Except for one of you, you're all
But
idiots.
I did ask some serious questions, like... do you believe that in order to better protect Americans from the threat of terrorism, law enforcement should be able to obtain information from American citizens via searches of homes, cars, personal computers, phone records, emails, or internet browsing history without the use of a traditional warrant? And I got a number of those that were maybes. I haven't seen a yes yet. But I have a number of those that said they would maybe be okay with that. And here's a yes. I found a yes. That's okay with that.
Are there any no's?
Oh, yeah, there's some no's.
Okay.
But just like that.
Thank God.
But, I mean, the fact
Scared
that there
me for
is
a minute,
even... and the thing is this one that said yes said that described themselves as a progressive. And
really?
Yeah. Do you believe that every criminal, even foreigner, should be given a lawyer in a speedy trial? Yes. And then they didn't finish it.
Well, it's one of the things that I like about libertarians, and it attracted me to the party initially, is the consistency of thought. It's you try to be consistent across the board as opposed to most Republicans just sort of they're knee-jerk reactionary and even most Democrats. I mean, most people involved in politics that just watch Bill O'Reilly or Rachel Maddow just are kind of reactionary and they don't really put a system of thought to what they believe. Yeah. And that's one of the things that I like about libertarians. We joke that Creighton's a nerd or that we're nerds, but you know, you have to really dig down and know exactly what you believe before you start evaluating situations.
Yeah, I feel like we try to apply the same logic to most situations.
Right.
Or just liberty in general, the logic of...
Does this follow the golden rule? Is this something that I would
Boo.
Want... Thank you. Sorry. Is this something that we would...
Boo, the golden rule.
Rabble. Is this something that we wouldn't want done to us? You know, would we do it to somebody else and we don't want it done to us? You know, is it voluntary or involuntary? Is someone forcing us to do something or is it a voluntary action? Are you taking away rights that you don't have the right to take that right away?
Well, I would say you never have the right to take away a right. It just depends on what you're defining as a right.
I'm saying if you murder somebody, we have the right to take your right to freedom away and lock you up to pay for that penalty.
Yeah, well, that's another 2 hours discussion for us to get into the theory of all
you,
that.
You forget. But, this is a Rothbardian anarcho-capitalist over here.
Right, and I'm a constitutionalist. So yeah.
I'm moving towards a Hans Hoppian.
Oh, really?
Oh, yes. Wow.
Move away from the natural law and move to argumentation ethics. But
you're
anyway.
You're hopping where?
Huh?
You're hopping where?
To the White House. No, but okay, this one's actually an example of how you know how important you know some of this stuff is and how little a lot of people know. I have the question, have you ever heard of the National Defense Authorization Act, also known as the NDAA? No. Have you ever heard of the Patriot Act? No. And then on the back, do you believe that law enforcement, including the presidential office, need more authority to combat terrorism, have too much, or the amount they have is now sufficient? And they said sufficient amount. So not only do they not know about the NDAA, they believe that the president has a sufficient amount. Do you think that if they knew about the NDAA, they would say too much? I mean, being informed about these things are, I mean, extremely important. And I have a number of people that never heard of the Patriot Act, never heard of the NDAA. Sufficient amount of authority? Yes. Terrorism's the most dangerous thing. I mean, it's just like it's almost like they're just been reading them off the TV. I mean,
yeah, we're talking about all these issues. Let's talk about our.
We're getting down to the last closing minutes. So thank you for the refresh there, Galt. You're becoming a professional broadcaster. What? You really are growing. It's a refresh. It's a reset.
I wanted to talk real quick about the activism we're going to do on campus later this month in our Young Americans for Liberty group. YL National has put out...
Right into the mic.
April all-out activism. There's four different activism ideas that they've presented, and I wanted to see what you guys thought about them. I think our chapter is going to try to do all of them. The first one was Occupy the Honor Roll. Mm-hmm. Where we would have a petition to redistribute grade GPAs, and
okay,
and
we're gonna overblow the satire too. We're probably gonna put up tents and have stuff. I mean, we're gonna really go.
I think that is tremendous.
All right. The second one was the reality game show quiz.
The price is wrong. Government or something.
Right. So we would ask people questions about pop culture. They'd get them all right. And then we'd ask them a question about their government and they wouldn't know. So we'd show them how much they know about pop culture, but not anything that they don't know very much about their own government and what controls their lives.
Yeah. And that day we're planning on having an actual game show that night.
Yeah.
That we're going to have people invited to. And
are you going
to
wear a tuxedo?
I'm actually thinking about going to Goodwill and finding like a leisure suit and wearing one of them bad comb overs from like the 1970s.
Awesome. Bob Barker.
With a really skinny microphone that's very, very
come on down.
And if you don't run down to the stage with your hands above your shoulders, then you're not doing it right. Yeah. Like, yeah!
The other activism was Visualize the Debt, which we did. And then
we're going to do some TSA stuff.
Oh, the TSA. We're going to build a body scanner and have people walk through it and give them beads when they come out the other side.
as long as you're not doing pat-downs,
we have a TSA uniform. And
I don't trust male college students to pat down other co-eds.
So that'll be April 16th through the 20th that week. Under the business building at IPUI. So if anybody listening goes to school and wants to help us out, we're going to
be
working on that.
Because I guarantee you the Occupy Wall Street one will definitely
be a lot of fun.
Oh, that
will definitely get some people hot-headed. So,
you could get in the school newspaper with that. I mean, that's pretty funny. It's clever.
And we got to videotape it and stuff, and that's the main point. But well, it's going to be a...
I know we're running out of time. I want to wrap this up with our idiot of the week.
Okay. One thing from the Libertarian Party side, if you are a poker player, on April 7th at the Antelope Club, there's a 3 o'clock game and a 7 o'clock game. The 3 o'clock game is a $25 buy-in. The 7 o'clock game is a $100 buy-in. It's a Texas Hold'em tournament. So check the LPIN.org website. Up at the page bar, just look for the word poker, check it out, and come join us. So 1 and 2 cash games as well. I don't know the gaming license number. I'm sorry to the government if you're listening. So go ahead, Galt.
All right. Well, I know our first idiot of the week was Rick Santorum. Mm-hmm. Then we had the Invisible Children CEO.
Yes.
And now...
was caught making invisible children on the internet.
And now...
Thank you.
Now, our idiot of the week is President Obama.
Oh, see, this is controversial. You were worried about this.
I know, and it's not because of something he did. It's because of something he said.
Okay.
He cited, he was mocking the GOP during his speech to some Democrats.
Okay, it's good so far.
He cited former President Hayes, and he said that... that Hayes said about the telephone, because he was the first president to use the telephone in the White House.
Mm-hmm.
He said that Hayes said, "It is a great invention, but who would ever want to use one?" Well, not only is that miscited, but Obama said that's why he's not on Mount Rushmore, is because he was technologically backwards.
Okay.
So after his speech, there's a picture of him using a BlackBerry.
Oh, see...
You know what? You guys are just haters.
You can't use a BlackBerry.
Haters.
He's accusing others of being unwilling to embrace new technology.
But he uses a BlackBerry.
But he's using a BlackBerry.
I'm an iPhone guy. Galt.
I'm a huge Android guy.
Yeah,
I've got my Zoom in my hands and my Galaxy Nexus in my pocket.
And I have my iPad. We use an iPad on the show.
Well, aren't you guys just special? Well,
yeah, guess who uses a BlackBerry in the room?
You know what? I'm going to
guess what? You know what? Forget the whole economics thing. That's why you're a nerd.
Well, I'm going to post this meme on the Facebook.
Whatever.
Page.
It was $10, and it had more than my old phone.
Because Obama's
worried
about the price of the phone.
You got
it. That's why I got it. I was going to drop $100 on an iPhone when I needed a phone.
You got what you paid for.
Yeah. It texts. It gives me GPS when I'm lost.
I'm going to post this meme on the Facebook page. So
hey,
so.
Kids out there, be careful of memeing. Okay.
It says President Obama called him technologically backwards. That's a bit coming from a guy with a BlackBerry.
don't Taylor Swift in front of a Cafe Monet.
Listen, it was really uncomfortable when Galt Taylor Swifted right before the show. It was really uncomfortable.
What?
We got pictures though. We'll post.
I don't even
them on,
know what you're talking about.
Yeah, we'll post the pictures of Galt.
It was a little
Taylor Swifting on the Facebook page. Go to WeareLibertarians.com.
It was pretty bad.
We want to thank you all for joining us on this week of We Are Libertarians. We'll show you the video later, Galt.
Me?
It's a South Park bit.
Gotcha.
So we want to thank everybody for joining us this week. For your hosts, Chris Spangle, Chris Galt, and Creighton Harrington, I want to thank you for joining us, and we'll see you next week.
Yeah, I have something to say, but I can't remember what it was.
All right, I'll go first then. But first, let's talk about... What did I say we were going to talk about?
I have no idea.
This podcast is produced by What is a Hoosier Productions.